I said there's a threefold order for working through the kinds of purifications from the pollutions of the two sorts I mentioned and the defilements, so that one can progress and go through the sealing, the sort of sealing that nature in physical life imposes upon spiritual growth and development. It is not natural to develop. Masters do not develop naturally. They don't just, oh yeah, we'll just fall and do that. It's unnatural. It is unnatural for humans to become superhuman. It is not natural in this world. It is a work of great skill. And someday nature will be different than it is now. But nature itself is also, so to speak, theologically fallen. It's straining, as it says in the New Testament, for the revelation of the children of light. It depends, the redemption and the liberation of nature depends upon the redemption and liberation of human beings. So, for initial work in purification, it's really necessary to become pretty much of a vegetarian for a while. You don't have to do it for your whole life or anything. It depends on the individual people. Some of you have already done these things and so on. But if one is going to get an even playing field and we'll get really serious about being able to get it together to not be encumbered by the tremendous baggage of pollutions that exist around people, then it's really pretty necessary to do a pretty serious fasting from red meats and impure-forming foods with daily use of esoteric prophylactic techniques, for example, rose oil, to the crown and the ajna and the throat and the heart and the solar plexus and the nape of the neck, which is dissolving of imperil and prophylactic against imperil, and the use of sandalwood oil or eucalyptus oil on these two vulnerable sections, the solar plexus and the nape of the neck. This covers not just imperil, but also other negative forces and obsessing forces. There is a soap that I put together that is a special formula for people doing serious imperil and cleansing of auric and nadic things and etheric channels that I call temple soap. And that, used with an auric burning technique afterwards, which is a separate instruction, is another thing that is done for these purifications. Drinking water that's magnified by a consecrated clear quartz from the temple that one sips each day is another way of working with this, another way in this kind of thing. Special prayer and meditation practices for the duration. Eucalyptus in boiling or really hot water in a little cup of eucalyptus oil at bedtime in the evening for the vapors to be in the air. Protect one very much and help one to raise up in sleep into higher vibrations and not be encumbered with certain kinds of astral pollutions and so on. And the use of eucalyptus oil in the treatment of certain things. The esoteric use of wormwood oil. Wormwood oil is has to be used very sparingly, and it's very powerful in certain kinds of ways. And the application of teachings about purity. To go through a period of time for that, ending in something like a vision quest or a vigil, is a very powerful way to begin purification practices. Some people have already done things like this or are not in need of this much purification. Some people are vegetarians and they do certain things, they know certain things and all that kind of stuff, and are not encumbered. Their auras are not encumbered. Their nadis are not encumbered with so much of this. They don't need to do that. But I'm talking about a sort of an average or normal person. That would be the beginning place. After initiation, there are more subtle means that can be used to help with the purity practices. When we get on into the Antarkarana building empowerment, a year from initiation, you will be quite versed in the use of various kinds of essential oils
and fragrances and more complex use of harmonic and toning and so on. But this is a basic summary of the probationer teachings on purity practices.
I want to say that it is absolutely vital in order to do this kind of work that we practice the Iliastra meditation and we practice it correctly. It is not a matter of becoming subjective, groggy, sleepy, going into a stupor. This kind of meditation is an intense effort. That's why it's short. I ask you to do it in a very short, over a very short period of about 5 minutes. It is an intense effort to make yourself more than awake, super awake, to awaken yourself into a calm clarity and to focus very, very much. And you kind of have to, it's kind of like trying to make a great high hurdle. You have to kind of prepare yourself and get going. You have to sit down and get yourself prepared. When you're prepared, then you make the effort to focus and to seek that light, bring that light and evoke that light. That may only, when you do start to have success with it may only come for a second at a time or 2 seconds at a time, but that's fine. And you will know generally when you've had a strong manifestation of it, because afterwards generally you'll get kind of a sort of distilling blue or purple or even violet kind of light that will come in after you have that contact. It's very important to develop your ability to evoke the Iliastra in order to do this kind of work. I want to stress that it is not something that makes you sleepy. It is something you have to be super, super awake to do. Now, I have strongly suggested that you do this first thing in the morning after you go to the bathroom, whatever, before you talk on the telephone, before you eat, before you get involved in any of your mundane activities, that you sit down and focus and do this meditation, because when you come out of sleep, there are still antikaranics that connect your mundane consciousness to the deeper layers of psychological consciousness that lead into the really higher forms of monadic consciousness, the higher mind and higher consciousness. And they dissipate as soon as you start working, doing mundane things. They separate completely. It's very hard to get back into it. So it's not good to wait till later in the day. It's good to do it as close as you can to awakening. But of course, you have to be awake. If you're one of those people who finds it hard to awake and you have to drink a lot of cups of coffee and everything in order to wake up and so on, don't do that. Don't eat or do anything interposing between. Just do what you have to do, take a shower, whatever you have to do. But before you get involved in mundane activities, do this meditation practice. It's only 5 minutes, and you have to do it. Remember, it's a super awakeness.
Blessed Spirit of Truth, inspire my lips and our ears that we may receive in Eucharist. Amen. Why is it that things need to be spoken out loud if there is to be power in the invisible world? Why doesn't thought alone have extreme power in the invisible world and in the material world? Why is it that thought has any power at all when it doesn't seem to be anything tangible? How do we know any of the great esoteric truths? How did people ever find out that you could scrape something off the skin of a certain toad and heat it and smoke it and have something more powerful than LSD? How did people ever find out about drying hemp and smoking it? How did people find out about medicinal herbs? It is not, as some scientists would say, a process of trial and error. if we were to put monkeys at a typewriter, even hundreds of thousands of monkeys at typewriters, the age of the universe wouldn't be long enough for them to produce a novel like, or even a great short story like an O. Henry story. These things do not come simply by chance. There is intelligence and guidance and everything, down to the tiniest electron and atom in the universe. How do we know about the birth and the life and the death of stars? We don't live 5 billion years. We can't observe a star being born and living its life and dying. The way scientists discover these things is by observing the entire spectrum of what exists and by correlating luminosity and other kinds of things, they're able to discover patterns and to understand the patterns of how things progress and the order of the progression. Imagine for a moment that we were visited by explorers from another universe who wished to understand human beings and how they came into being and how they were born and how they lived and how they died. But these beings live only for 24 hours in human terms. They live their entire lives in 24 hours. And so therefore, to them, human beings would be great frozen things. Imagine that these explorers were very tiny, very, very tiny, and that human beings would seem to be great frozen, unmoving, or very slowly changing masses, frozen in almost frozen in time. How would they discover the process of how human beings came into birth and lived their lives and died? Well, they would have to go around and inspect all kinds of specimens of human beings in different walks of life and in different modes of doing things and frozen in time, so to speak. And when they finally had developed enough of a view, enough of a theory, they would be able to understand what the life cycle of a human being was from just this small bit of time, frozen time that's moving very slowly for them. And that is the way we discover the life cycles of stars. And when we do that, we develop what the Tibetans call view and what the Greeks call theory, theoria, which means a vision of something that is beyond what we can know with our physical senses. A theory is a way of seeing beyond that which our own personal eyes and ears and nose, these eyes of flesh and these ears of flesh, and our own life experience can possibly teach us. And there, of course, can be many, many wrong theories, and theory always has to be modified. But truth grows out of the correct theory, and theory will be able to predict certain results, and theory is what we have to work with. And it's the same in the working with the esoteric and the unseen. You can go to people who have very bad theories that only apply to certain limited conditions and then fall apart. These are people like the clairvoyants and the channelers and the lower psychics who are able to sometimes see and experience the invisible worlds, but not with any real intelligence or understanding. They sometimes are like a 3-year-old child is able to walk on the streets of New York for 5 or 10 minutes, who would come back then and tell you his stories about what he had seen. And of course, he wouldn't really know or understand or comprehend what he had seen. He would come back with things that were framed in terms of the categories and images that lived in his own mind. These are the poor theoreticians. And then there are the great theoreticians, the ones who have worked with those whose theories were most powerful, most workable, the great theoreticians of the West and of the East, whose visions of reality have been altered for the better and changed and corrected and made even more viable over great amounts of time. The theory that Blavatsky called the secret doctrine, or that is called in Agni Yoga the teachings, or that is called by other names, that comes through some of the great teachings of the Kabbalah and the Rosicrucians and the Tibetans and Tibetan Buddhists and so on. And the way that we know or can know about that which is invisible, intangible, inaudible and imperceptible to us, the ways that we can know about these things are through the deposit of high quality psychic experience that beings have had down through history, that has been then kept and written down and passed on from teachers to disciples and added to, and that has been verified by people. That is how we know about the unseen worlds and the worlds of spiritual reality. It is not from our own personal experience, although it strikes a chord with us at an intuitive level, it strikes a chord of knowingness with us, it accords with things in us that we vibrate to. And so the way that we can know these things is not intellectually, through intellectual knowledge, but through a higher kind of knowledge, which Master Jesus called our main fidelity, faithfulness, and which we might also call intuitive sources and intuitive resources, which are the basic glue that keeps us bound to our ideals and to that which we persevere in. Not because they're simply mental ideals, but because they are things that grow out of the depths of us that very often don't have words that can be expressed. So there is much folklore. There is much bodies of all kinds of occult traditions and magical traditions and black magical traditions. There are spiritual doctrines, spiritual theologies, and so on. But there are the great teachings, we call us with a capital T, the teachings, and they occur in all cultures. You will find, for example, in the... one of the examples I've given you is a rather complete outline of pre-Taoist beliefs in China about death and the hells. And the reason I have you read that is because it's something that most of us are not as familiar with as the Greek or the Hebrew or the Egyptian or the Tibetan Buddhist or other kinds of teachings or American Indian, but because they accord with them exactly. What is taught in the deeper Hermetic traditions, in the Tibetan books of the dead, and in other kinds of traditions about death and the gateway of death and the door of death and things and so on, you will find in the ancient Chinese teachings as well. And where do they come from? Not from a single source, not from one person, not from one great teacher whose philosophy was spread throughout the whole world among the people as far away as the Aborigines in Australia and as far as the great sophisticated dynasties of China. Rather, it is experience that human beings have had all over and validates itself with people throughout history. One of the things, for example, one of the bits of knowledge that is had is that there is a thing which we may call many things, we'll call it for to make it simple, the soul, human soul, that which survives the body after the body dies, and that which pre-exists the body before it comes into birth, and that soul or that psychic reality, after the death of a person, stays or dwells near that person in relationship, usually to the head, for a period of 72 hours or 3 days, and that during that time, then, of course, if a person is buried into the earth, there are usually no consequences, even though, as we know, when we cut a tree or when a person's body, when a person dies, the body doesn't die instantly. The body is slowly dying like a tree dies after it's been cut. And there is a link between the soul and the body for 72 hours that is a very powerful link. And if in the cultures where bodies were burned, where they were cremated, as in the Hindu culture, if the cremation were done before this 72-hour period were up, a great deal of agony and pain could be inflicted upon the soul of the person because the person still had these connections with the body. And that three-day period is a very important period in Tibetan Buddhism, and the books of the dead or in other traditions. One is working with the deceased for 3 days in a very special way after the demise, because the deceased is building his upward path. He is building his pathway into the light of that which he goes, and he's slowly folding up and withdrawing all the structures and the subtle structures from his physical body, like Venetian blinds being folded up. And it is after that 3 days that the person then enters into another kind of state. And that state lasts for about 49 days, or about 7 weeks. The period of time, for example, that the Master Jesus was seen and was visible in his resurrected body to the disciples is the same period of time, usually. But the dynamics of grief and of earthboundness or earth contact with the dead is traditional in cultures all over the world. People have had these experiences, these lower psychic experiences that are the easiest kind for people to have. The seeing of ghosts, the communication with the dead in dreams and all those sort of things, or the seeing of the dead out of just the corner of the eye and then turning and the person's not there and so on. 7 weeks, and in the case of the Master Jesus, instead of being a frightened specter, he was, of course, a very high enlightened being, but he was still, for 7 weeks, so to speak, could be seen and was seen by many people. If you read the New Testament accounts, it says over 400 people saw the Master Jesus after his resurrection for a period of about 7 weeks, and then at the end of that time came the ascension. He ascended to heaven, so to speak. And the same thing is occurring in many, many cultures in their description of what happens after death. Why is this important to us? Because it illustrates to us the ways that we have of knowing certain things. The times in this country when spiritualism flourished the most were after the Civil War and after World War I. Because lots of people had had lots of people very close to them die suddenly. And there are innumerable accounts in World War I of mothers or sisters or wives dreaming, and in World War II as well, of their husbands or brothers or fathers trapped in a submarine and calling out to them and dying, and then getting a letter a few weeks later that on that very date was the date that the person was trapped in the submarine and died, and so on. These experiences, these kinds of experiences that people have, especially in times of war and slaughter and death and this sort of thing, these experiences are the experiences that cause people to know and to understand that the gateway and the doorway of death is not a doorway into nothingness and into meaninglessness, but rather that there is a survival of that which is essential in a person, and that survives death. When I have talked to many people who have been very close and had marriages, most marriages are karmic. They are not of a really high spiritual nature, but they are more of a karmic nature. And the experience that most people have with the death of a partner is that they feel the intensity of the loss very much the first few days. Then they go through a period of darkness and grieving that lasts for a couple of months, about 7 weeks. And after that, and they feel, though, very close to the departed one. And then after that time, after 7 weeks, all of a sudden they begin to feel the distance and things lift. And pretty soon there's no longer in a healthy kind of situation a feeling even of closeness or of visitation or anything else. And eventually a person is freed. And this is considered to be a healthy grieving process. And the successful conclusion of the grieving process is when the marriage is sort of ended. And that's why in Christian marriage we say, until death do us part, because the marriage is over at that time. But there are people who are linked much more closely than that, and whose association, whose partnership is far more than merely a karmic association. And those people feel things very differently. They don't feel the moving away of the other person after the 7 weeks is over or so. They feel a closeness. They continue their relationship with that person. And that is the interesting experience to look at, because, in fact, death is not something that separates the people who are related to each other at a high or deep level. Because when person A and person B have a relationship of their essential natures, of who they really are as individual monadic beings, and they have a relationship that has existed at that kind of depth, then death cannot separate them. And the relationship still exists. It is as though the other person may be downstairs for a while, or the other person may have taken a short trip. But the relationship continues, and it goes on, and it lives. And that is because when people relate at the level of their essential being, rather than at the more shallow levels of personality that most marriages are based upon, then death has no power to separate them.